Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates once said that for too many Americans, military service is something for others to do. A trend has been building ever since institution of the all-volunteer force. Enlistees come from a shrinking number of locations, and more come from families from which someone else has already served. With the problems this engenders, and some possible solutions, James Winnefeld, he's a retired Navy admiral and former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Admiral Winnefeld, good to have you on.
Good morning, Tom. Great to be here.
And I think you're not probably the first military officer to make this observation, but it sounds like it's the red states that are producing most of the military members, or at least those that enlist nowadays. How would you describe it?
Well, as an apolitical retired military officer, I tend not to describe things in terms of red or blue or anything like that. But the fact of the matter is, as the article that I co-authored with Amy Schaefer points out, increasingly, more and more of our recruiting base is coming from the states in the South and the Southwest. Part of the United States, to the detriment of recruiting efforts in other parts of the country. And that's a little bit disturbing.
And why is that the case, though?
It's hard to tell. I think that the population, the demographics in those parts of the country gravitate towards different types of media. They have different belief systems and that sort of thing. It's really hard for me to point out one specific thing that causes those parts of the country to gravitate more towards the military, but the statistics speak for themselves.
Is there an economic factor there? Do they tend to come from lower income than average?
That's a good question. Across the board in the military, our enlisted recruiting base would tend to come from lower income parts of the demographic, but lower income parts of the demographic exist all across the country. So it's hard for me to point to that as a particular factor in a disproportionate number of people coming from either military families or specific regions of the country. So I don't know if economics really has that much to do with it.
Well, regardless of what the causes are, then, what are the effects that it has on the military?
Well, in the military, first of all, we have an all-volunteer force, which has done tremendous good. In my 37 years in the Navy, I observed a dramatic change from when I first entered the service at the tail end of not having an all-volunteer force to when I left. And I can tell you, Tom, that we've got the finest young men and women, I think, who have ever served this country in uniform right now. So we still are getting great people into the service. The detrimental effect comes when portions of the country, either demographically or regionally, don't have a stake in that service. They're underrepresented in the service. And I think it creates a separation, a civil-military divide, that isn't necessarily harmful on the face of it, but it can impact decisions on the use of force and also on the actual tangible support that the military receives financially, for example, from Congress.
Do you think it makes it maybe too easy to commit to the use of force without really understanding the real consequences of that?
Well, that's one of the key points that Amy and I make in the article, and that is that when you're making a decision as to whether to use force, really it's striking a balance between to what degree are the interests of the nation at stake versus what is the cost in using force to protect that interest? And that cost can come in many forms. It can be opportunity cost if you use force in one place and not in another. It can come in terms of cost pushing against international law. It certainly comes at a financial cost. But the cost that is most important in this context is the cost in blood. When we put our young men and women in harm's way, we have to take that into account as to whether we're going to use force. And if a smaller portion of the country has a stake in that particular part of the decision, then it would tend to lower the threshold for whether and when and where we would use force. So that I think there is a factor there, Tom.
I guess it's a little bit ironic because often when losses do mount in recent years' conflicts, recent decades' conflicts, it is often those from the places that don't produce their proportional share of military members that are the first to back away from the activity that sent them there in the first place.
Well, and that is indicative of the importance of having this representation across the population and across the country. I thought one of the statistics that Amy brought up that we used in the article was really telling to me. It was the Harvard study that indicated at one point that 60% of the youth in the country supported sending young women into combat, but that only 15% of them would actually volunteer to go. That pointed out to me this disparity that we're talking about.
We're speaking with James Winnefelt, Jr., a retired Navy admiral and former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What's your take on the fact that military service is tending to be more and more of a family affair?
My father happened to be in the military. I'm a fourth-generation military person, and I also have a son in the military. So you can imagine I'm not critical at all of families who send sons and daughters into the military. I laud them for their service and sacrifice and courage. But I would like to see a little broader distribution across the demographic of the country.
We have the situation that certain locales are providing an outsized share of the military. What can be done to change that to make it more evenly distributed?
Well, Tom, it's certainly true that the services are trying very hard at this. They know this. They want to have the whole demographic and the regions in the country well represented. So their recruiting efforts extend across the country. I do, though, believe it's sort of a market. And that funding for recruiting competes with other much-needed funding for other sectors of what the military does. So the tendency would be to settle for the minimum amount of funding that would get the most qualified people into the service. And if you're going to expand your recruiting efforts a little more aggressively in areas that are underrepresented, that's going to cost money. And money is short right now in the services, but I do think it's something that we should consider closely of ramping up just a little bit more our efforts recruiting in underrepresented areas.
But do you think the content of the recruiting is adequate to convince people, hey, this is not such a bad way to go?
Well, you know, I learned a long time ago that I'm not an expert in recruiting content. I remember sitting in an all-flag officer meeting in the Navy, and they showed us a commercial that was a spine-tingling commercial about the Navy. And the lights came up, and they asked us, you know, what do you think? And we know what every one of you is thinking right now, and that is, why have I never seen this commercial? And the fact is, we're not trying to recruit you. We're trying to recruit young 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds to come in the Navy. And the point was that the places where recruiting videos and material is shown and the content of that material, I have no idea what it ought to be because there are marketing experts who are much better at that than I am. But it's certainly worthy of consideration that we examine the recruiting content to make sure that we're attracting as many different types of people into the military as we can get, because it only helps us when we do.
Because we have seen different strategies over the years. There's some showing the academic side of it. You can become a cybersecurity expert. You can become a computer coder, all kinds of jobs, careers that are not shooting, that are not frontline combat. And then there have been techniques showing how tough it is. You have to jump from airplanes, you have to go through basic training, and they bring that out to try to maybe, I don't know, inspire people to try something that they wouldn't have thought of. So it seems like they've tried the spectrum, and yet the results kind of go on as they do.
Yeah, and Tom, it's interesting. We've even tried to appeal to their moms with commercials that show all the good that the military does, disaster relief and humanitarian assistance and that sort of thing. And I would hasten to add that we really are not hurting too badly for bringing people into the military. And that may be part of the problem is that we're actually attracting, you know, a pretty good quality recruit in these days. It's just not from all across the country and in all demographics like we'd like to see it.
And so even though you're getting the numbers, basically the issue is that it's the divide between society as a whole and the military that is engendered by this issue of where people come from.
Exactly. And so in terms of recruiting content, it may be that you devote a little bit more resources to recruiting in areas that are underrepresented, even though the hit rate on those ads may not be as high. If you have more of them, maybe you'll get more people in. And then potentially adjusting the content, which again, I'm not an expert on, to appeal to those areas that are underrepresented. So there's probably a lot of creative work to be done. I know the services are working this hard. I just encourage them, egg them on as much as we can to try to keep in mind that we want to expand the space as much as we can.
James Sandy Winnefelt, Jr. is a retired Navy admiral and former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
We'll post a link to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.